Okay, welcome to week number two of our Great Jewish Books course in memory of Dr. Mark Weinberg of blessed memory. This particular week has been sponsored by Janine Lombroso and family in memory of Janine's beloved father, Maurice Lombroso, Moshe Ben Yitzchak. May his memory be a blessing and a liyata to the neshama from the learning that we will do tonight. So we thank you for the sponsorship, and that's the result of the cookies that you have in back. Next week is not yet sponsored, so make sure, if nobody comes forward, that you eat before you get here, because not yet sponsored. But please see me, send me a text or an email if you're interested in sponsoring. Okay, I mentioned last week that the 20 or so books that we chose, I chose with some help from some others. But it's arbitrary. They could be debated which ones should be on, which ones shouldn't be on. There are a number of works on our list that are not debatable. They are clear. If you're going to do any work on Jewish scholarship, these personalities are on that list. And on the top of that short list is tonight's topic of Rashi. There is not a course out there. You could not discuss Jewish scholarship and not start with Rashi. There's no way around it. It's impossible to overstate what it is that he has meant to the Jewish people in so many different ways. So I say that as a disclaimer. It's also impossible to try to cover what he meant in an hour, hour and 5 minutes or so that we have. So this will be an overview. I'm acknowledging that. I hope it will inspire interest to study more Rashi, and we'll cover as much as we can. The basic format that I'd like to hold to throughout the course is taking the hour, hour, 10 minutes that we have together and dividing up between a little biographical sketch so we understand exactly who the author was, and some actual excerpts from their works, that we actually study their words together, we learn a little bit together, and that's what I hope to do tonight with Rashi. Obviously, Rashi, if you wanted to, we could spend several years learning all of the Rashi, so I just chose a couple that I thought were significant or meaningful to me, and I hope that you'll find meaningful as well. Most weeks, at least the ones that I'm teaching, will most likely be sort of half the time biographical, and then we'll go into the studying. Tonight, I think we're going to go back and forth a little bit between some Rashis and some of the concepts of the biographical sketch of who Rashi was. So let us jump right into this great luminary of the Jewish people, Reb Shlomo Yitzchaki, as we know as Rashi. Following along on your sheets, there's no equal in the Jewish people to anyone like him, anyone who has provided education to the masses. Rashi opened up Torah, literally. He opened up the Chumash, he opened up the Gemara. You cannot learn either without starting with the Rashi. He's an inspiration to scholars as well as your first grader's first opportunity to learn. They both study Rashi, which is really part of his genius, to be able to both at the same time, as well as giving guidance to the Jewish people. His words have become what we are and what we believe. With absolute commitment to clarifying the complexity of every letter, every word, every phrase of the Torah, what he accomplished was seamlessly blending explanations of text together with storytelling, together with moral lessons, in this gift that he gave us. And there's no one like him. Either we have commentaries who've written a textual base, or an ethical work, or moral work, or storytelling, but to combine in one work all of that in one piece of scholarship that's timeless, that is studied and is as relevant today, 1,000 years after it was first written, in a concise, sweet, loving, illuminating way, he has, simply put, no equal. Just to describe a little bit, he holds the student's hands through the text, literally as you're working through. He writes, "My job is to clarify pshuto shel mikra. My goal," Rashi says, "is I just want to explain the simple meaning of the text, that when you come away from my explanation with this verse, you know what it is that the text is describing." Using the words, as I quoted Rabbi Beryl Wein last week, I'm fond of quoting him. This is not an exact quote, but his basic quote. "Simultaneously, he is our first great teacher, spreading honey over the words to make Torah sweet, And at the same time, he is our postgraduate mentor, where only after years of study do we appreciate his genius and depth. And that's an unparalleled quality to both be studied, as I mentioned before, by a first grader and by the greatest of yeshiva students all at the same time. And his personality shines forth from his writings, and I hope that what we'll do tonight is we'll actually read from some of his excerpts and we'll see that personality coming through, honest, intellectually honest and humble, with unassuming faith. He is both soft, gentle, and compassionate, yet strong in his convictions and confident in divine justice and salvation, tolerant of humanity and its foibles, but most of all, what you see in his writings that shines forth is his love of Torah, his love of the Jewish people, and his love of our land, all of which drips forth from his every comment. Okay, that was my basic introduction to Rashi. Let's get into a little bit about his life and some of his writings. So why is he called Rashi? So his name was Shlomo ben Yitzchak. So Rabban Shlomo ben Yitzchak is Reish Shin Yud, or what we know and love as Rashi. The Jewish people have added another acronym or meaning to that Reish Shin Yud, and that is Rabban Shel Yisrael, the Rebbe, the teacher of the Jewish people. And that is simply put because he is the definition of the Rebbe of the Jewish people, as everything that we have, all Torah, through Gemara, Chumash, all of Tanakh, his commentary, he has become our Rebbe. He was born in, now, an American would pronounce that the Troyes, but I know that that's not, the Trois, is that right? Okay, so you all know that already. So that's where he was born in northern France in 1040. Now, just a brief historical point. In 1040, the Ashkenazi community has taken hold in France and in Germany. It has not been there all that long. The Gemara, which we discussed last week, was sealed 300 to 400 years prior in Babylonia. And over the course of those 300 to 400 years, from the year 700 to the year 1000, the Jews migrated, or a family, the Ashkenazi Jewish community really began with about 300 families. The entire Ashkenazi world is descended from a sum total of about 300 families that settled in the Rhineland and in France. And from there, the Ashkenazi community flourished, but we're really from a pretty small core of Jews. And so Rashi finds himself in that area 300 to 400 years into its development. It's claimed that Rashi was a descendant, direct descendant of David HaMelech. Rashi himself never makes that claim in any of his writings. There's no way to verify exactly, but it's one of, there are many, many legends. He was so larger than life. We'll see a number of legends that we'll discuss tonight. There are a lot of legends. So that's one of them, that he was descended from David HaMelech. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just not saying that we know for sure that it is true, but that is one of the legends of Rashi, that he was a direct descendant from David HaMelech. And there are a number of two very, very famous legends that surround his birth, which again, no way to prove these, but I share them because if you look up anything on Rashi, you will find these two legends are always attached and affiliated with Rashi. And as Rabbi Wein, who I quoted before, likes to say all the time, whenever he quotes a legend about any of the personality, he does many biographical lectures, so he quotes all the legends, and he always says, I don't know that this legend is true. But, he says, they don't tell the same legends about the Chafetz Chaim and Richard Nixon. So, neither might be true, but it says something about the person, the types of stories that they tell about them. So they're worth telling just to know what it is that they say. So the two famous legends about Rashi's birth, one is that his father was a very poor vintner. He had a vineyard, he sold wine, very, very poor, and he and his wife were childless. And one day, his father, different stories exactly how it came across a very, very precious gem. And it was so precious and so expensive, there was nobody in the town who could afford it other than the town priest who wanted it for one of his crosses or some type of form of Christianity. And Rashi's father, as the legend goes, unsure of what to do, he couldn't decline and he couldn't say yes, he didn't want to do anything. So when he took a ship to travel to wherever he needed to go to sell it to him, threw it into the sea and claimed that it had gotten lost, that he wouldn't have to sell it to the idolatry of Christianity. And as the legend goes, either a heavenly voice emanated or it came to him in a dream, that just as you threw away that precious gem, I will give to you a precious gem that will illuminate all of the lights of the Jewish people. And that was in the form of Rashi. That's one famous legend about Rashi's birth. There's a second one that when Rashi's mother was pregnant, she traveled to Worms, Vermeiza. And while she was there, she was in a narrow alleyway. And while she was walking through the alleyway, a chariot or horses came charging down for whatever they were after, and she had nowhere to go. So she pressed herself up against the wall in an attempt to escape, and the wall, so to speak, opened up to give her space indented in to be able to allow her there. And if you go to Vermeiza, you go to the city of Worms today, they'll point to a spot where there's an indentation in the wall. Rabbi Wein put this in his history book, a picture of this spot where there's literally a recess in the wall. And the legend is, that's where Rashi's mother pressed up against the wall to be able to save herself from the oncoming horses. I'm not here to verify, I have no idea. But those are the types of legends that they say about Rashi. And the reason why you have such Rashi is because he was such a luminary. These legends arose as to his origins. And again, for all I know, they're completely true. I'm not here to say one way or another, other than to share the stories about him. From a very early age, he distinguished himself as a scholar. He was sent off, he was born again in Troyes. He was sent off to Worms to study. What's the correct French pronunciation of?
Troyes.
No, not Troyes, Worms.
Worms.
Vermis? Okay.
How do you spell it?
It's spelled like Worms, W-O-R-M-S in English. I don't know how it's spelled in English. It doesn't matter. When I say that, that's what I refer to. It's all good. In any case, by the time he's 8, he's sent off to study by the great Jewish minds, the leaders of the Jewish people in Worms, in Mainz, and from eventually returns to Troyes in 1065 at the age of 25. He's born in 1040. By the age of 25, he's come back and he's already a distinguished scholar. He comes back to found his own yeshiva, and he comes back to become the Av Beis Din, the head of the courts of the city of Troyes, which was a major city at the time. It was in the crossroads of the French-German trade routes, and there were two major fairs, what was called the Cold Fair and the Hot Fair, one in the spring and one in the coming out of the winter. And so it was a metropolis kind of area, and that exposed Rashi to a great number of Jews and non-Jews and familiarity with many different elements of the world. It's alleged that he was a vintner himself, selling wine or making wine for a living. Unclear if that's actually true or not. He clearly had a tremendous knowledge of the winemaking process. Whether or not he actually did so, it's also reported that he did not want to ever take any money, not for being a teacher, not for being a rav in town. Throughout his days. The house of Rashi is a very famous house. The development, Rashi did not have any sons, but he had three daughters, Yocheved, Miriam, and Rachel. Parenthetically, we know almost nothing about his wife, not mentioned in writings. Literally, we know nothing. So scholars allege that it seems either she was completely in the background, or more likely they allege that she died at a very young age. And Rashi developed a very close relationship with his daughters, which we do know about. And we again have very little information about his wife. There are a number of legends about his daughters as well. They were clearly well-educated. That much is not legend. That much we know. He taught them to read and to write. There are legends that they wore tefillin, which may or may not be true. But they were clearly women of stature. He had a close relationship with them, and they were very much involved in a lot of his scholarship and letter writing. And they married some of them, some great scholars as well. And their children, Rashi's grandchildren, became known as what's known as the Ba'alei Tosfos. The Ba'alei Tosfos, if you open up a page of the Talmud, on the one side of the page is Rashi's commentary, and on the other side are what's known as the Tosfos. And the Tosfos are primarily the grandchildren of Rashi. Rashi's eldest daughter, Yocheved, married a man named Meir. Rabbeinu Meir, and they had a number of children, Rabbeinu Shmuel ben Meir, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Meir, Rashbam, the Rivam, Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, who was known as Rabbeinu Tam. For those who study Gemara, those three names, the Rashbam, the Rivam, and the Rabbeinu Tam, are principal Ba'alei Tosfos, and they are all grandchildren of Rashi, and they had children, and so the house of Rashi, Rabbi Beryl Wine, has an 8-lecture series on the house of Rashi, just going through all of the personalities and the accomplishments, all that came directly from Rashi and his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren. And one of the brilliant parts of the whole thing, and we'll see a little bit later, Rashi's grandchildren didn't always agree with Rashi. There were some major, major disputes between Rashi's grandchildren and Rashi himself in very many important areas of halacha. One other biographical background is in the last 10 years of Rashi's life, he lived during the Crusades. He died in 1105, and as you know, the first Crusade was launched in 1096. And this was a terrible time for the Jews of the Rite. If we were giving a history class, we would spend a whole lecture on the Crusades. But just to briefly mention, it literally destroyed entire communities in the Rhineland and France. And Rashi lived through that, and that had an impact. Again, it was just towards the last 10 years of his life. Before that, he wasn't, you know, always Gan Eden for the Jews in Christian Europe, but it wasn't terrible. But the last 10 years were terrible because the Crusades, as you know, also wasn't a one-time event. It actually lasted for many, many decades. And so the last 10 years of his life were very much surrounded by that. And a lot of the questions that he dealt with in the later years of his life were surrounding the Crusades. And a lot of them had to do with Jews who were forcibly converted, who then wanted to come back. And this is one of the places where Rashi really established himself. This again was towards the end of his life. But we spoke about this, for those who were here, during the Great Controversy series that we did last year. This history repeated itself, of course, during the Spanish Inquisition, in which Jews were forcibly forced to convert. And some did and some didn't. Those who didn't either were expelled or lost their life. And those who did, you know, managed to salvage their businesses and their family. And then when things passed, they tried to come back, or they escaped from in this case, France, or they escaped from Spain, and they went back to the Jewish communities and elsewhere. And then you had these terrible situations, very, very tragic situations, in which you have a community of survivors, similar to what we've gone through in our own lifetime, community of survivors. And in a community of survivors, what that meant was everybody in that community had lost a loved one to a crusade, to a pogrom, to some Christian who murdered them because they refused to convert. And they had to pick up their pieces of their life and move on. And then, a year, a couple months later, a family would come in who was intact. And the reason why they were intact is because they converted. And they went that route. And then they said, "We were just joking. We just wanted to survive. We kept our business. We were able to sell it off. And now we're here. We're here with our money, we're here with our family, and I want Maftir Yonah on Yom Kippur." And there was a lot of tension, a tremendous amount of tension, which I say that tongue-in-cheek in jest, but it really was not a laughing matter, because most of the communities did not want to take them back. Because if this was the trial of our time, and everybody in the community withstood the test and had family members that died and were killed, and then all of a sudden you show up, it was not so simple. And Rashi ruled time and time again that we are obligated to take anyone back. And it didn't matter that they converted, it didn't matter that they practiced Christianity. A Jew who wants to come home, Rashi ruled over and over again, is a Jew who is allowed home. And he ruled so forcibly, and that was one of the ways in which he, again, really established himself as a leading authority. He already was quite a scholar and authority by that point. But that was one of the issues that he had to deal with. One other legend, let me just mention, in regards to the Crusades, this legend is almost definitively apocryphal as far as the scholars and historians are concerned. But Duke Godfrey of Bouillon, did I say that right?
Bouillon.
I'm not even going to try. Who was a real historical person, that much is clear, but the legend goes, came and stopped off in Troyes to speak to Rashi before proceeding on to Jerusalem during the Crusades. And he wanted Rashi's blessings, and Rashi in effect told him, the way the legend goes, that for 3 days you're going to be successful in overtaking the city, and then on the fourth day you're going to be repelled, and you're going to come back here to France in utter defeat. So defeated, you're only going to have 3 horses with you when you return. And Du Godfrey was so angered by Rashi's prediction that he swore that if indeed your words are not true, when I come back here victorious, you know, I'm going to, whatever he said, slaughter the whole town. And as the legend goes, what Rashi said happened, and he came back, but he came back with four horses. And so he came back to the town to give it to the Jews of Twa along with Rashi. And as they entered the gates of the town, the legend goes a stone fell from the gate and killed one of the horses on the way in. That's the story. That's almost definitively apocryphal legend, but it is also repeated in every writing that you see about Rashi. You'll see that legend. You'll see that legend as well. Okay, that's a little bit of background. Let's get to some of his commentary. His most monumental work is his commentary on Chumash. His grandson Rabbeinu Tam, who I mentioned, Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Meir, wrote on the top of page 2, he said, I could have duplicated my grandfather's commentary to the Talmud. Now we could debate whether or not that's true or not. Many have tried. But he wrote, I could have done that. But his commentary on Chumash, no one. No one can touch Rashi's commentary on Chumash, the combination of, as I said before, earlier, scholarship, knowledge of the world, medrash, explanation of text, moral and ethical lessons, an understanding of human psychology. No one could have possibly, in such a concise, relevant manner, that is irreplicable. You just can't do it. It is simply, there are over 300 commentaries on Rashi's commentary today, and new commentaries are coming out every year. But 300 full commentaries dedicated simply to understanding Rashi's commentary. What he did in his commentary to Chumash is work through a pasuk, and I want to bring an example in a moment. Working through the problems in the pasuk, and then combing through all the literature of the Medrash, all the literature of the Talmud, every place where that verse is discussed, and chose the one, two comments in a concise manner that will bring it to life, that will make it understandable, approachable, both to the first grader and to the scholar. And all the commentaries after Rashi are, why did he choose this? Why did he say it like this? Why this word? Just explaining and expounding upon what he did. You cannot print a Chumash today without Rashi. You just can't. Unless you're acknowledging why you're not. But you just have to, because he is the starting point for every understanding of Chumash that we have. Blending lessons in Hebrew grammar and vocabulary, logical explanations of the text, as I mentioned, human psychology, using metaphor, allegory. It's all there. It's all concise. And every word is a gem. It shows a keen understanding of science, medicine, technology. Everything is there. And we're always working backwards to understand what was he bothered by that he makes this comment. What's wrong in the text that caused him to have to comment on this? One more point, and then let's start learning a little bit together. A Rashi script. Some people are familiar. There's a special script called Rashi script. So the great historical irony of Rashi script is if you were to show it to Rashi, he would have no idea what you were showing him. Because Rashi's script, that circular curved font, was created in the late 1400s when the printing press came into and they started printing Chumashim. So together with the Chumashim, they started printing Rashi. They wanted to distinguish the text of the Chumash from the text of the commentaries. So a printer created an adaptation of what was then a Sephardic semi-cursive font, and he adapted it for what was known as Rashi script. Rashi had died 300 years prior. He never saw it and would never be able to read Rashi script, even though it bears his name as the classic Rashi script. Let's take a pause. Let's start a little bit. I mentioned that in Rashi's commentary, he was soft, optimistic, full of love of the Jewish people and of Torah and our land. I'd like to share with you as an opening, Rashi's first comment. And I want to, before you look into it on your own, just think for a moment. Here is the most monumental work, literally, post-Talmud. How would you start? Bereshis Baro Elokim. The Torah starts with the first pasuk. Bereshis Baro Elokim. What should Rashi's first comment be? He's got the whole world in front of him, and he's got to start. Where? With what does Rashi want to start? And I want to add to that question, what I want to study with you is his first comment to every book of the Chumash. His first comment to Bereshis, his first comment to Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Devarim. We'll look at them together right now. And I want to, I think you'll see it on your own, there's a theme as Rashi opens up each book that he's communicating to us. And I want to read through, we'll read through all of them together now. And on your own, what's the message? Beyond just the comment that he makes, what message is he conveying to the Jewish people as we open up? You know, every time you start a new book, it's like, it's new in shul, it's fresh, a new book. And the first comment that Rashi makes. So if you look at the bottom of page 4, I think it's page 4, no, 2? Yeah, sorry, I got my pages mixed up here. I have the addendum in source. I really originally had the addendum on the top of the new page, and then I just went over onto page 7, so I figured to save 100 pieces of paper, so I put it in the bottom of page 2. I hope you'll forgive me. Let's start his first comment. I'm going to read it in English. I gave you the Hebrew if you preferred there as well. Rashi starts with a question. Now, this is his first comment in Chumash, and his question, he starts with a comment from Rabbi Yitzchak, one of the sages in the Medrash, who asks, why does the Torah start with the story of creation? Now, if the Torah is really a book of law, which is his assumption in his question, which we could debate by the time he finishes this comment whether or not he still thinks that or not. But if Torah is a book of law, where should we start? Start with the law. The first law that's given to the Jewish people as a whole takes place in the middle of Sefer Shmot, when the Jewish people are standing at the foot of Har Sinai, or really they're still in Egypt, and Hashem says to them, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, tells them about the new moon and declaring Rosh Chodesh. That's the first law that's given to the Jews as a people. Rashi asks, let's start with that. A law book should start with law. Why is it starting with the story of creation? And Rashi quotes, why does it begin here? Koach ma'asav higid la'amo, to tell his nation about his strength of his actions, his ability to create the entire world. Rashi says, Shem yomru mos ha'olam li'Yisrael, that the nations of the world will say to us, you are thieves. Top of the page, page 3. If they'll say to us, you are robbers, because you took by force the lands of the seven nations of Canaan. This is Rashi's first comment. That there'll be a time when the nations of the world will say to us, oh, the land of Israel is yours, is it? When you got there, was it empty? Was it desolate? Was it barren? No. There were the lands of Canaan. 31 nations that dwelled in the land. You came. You fought a war. You kicked them out. You're thieves. Don't claim this land is yours. Says, well, that's we're going to hear that claim. We continue to hear that claim. Ad hayom hazeh, until today. We will reply to them, Bereshit bara Elokim. The earth belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He created the whole world. He created it, and he gave it to whom he pleased. And when he willed it to those who he gave it to, he took it back from them and gave it to those to whom he desired. That's Rashi's first comment. What's his message of his first comment?
The land of Israel belongs to us.
The land of Israel belongs to us. Why? Because God created the world, and he gave it to us when he desired to give it to us. Now remember the historical context of where Rashi is writing in. The exile took place almost 1,000 years prior to the Beis HaMikdash. Oh, it was 1,000 years. Year 70, the Beis HaMikdash, second temple is destroyed, and the Jews are sent into exile. Now remember, the first exile was how long?
70
years. And then they go back after the Purim story, they rebuild. They're exiled by the Romans after the second temple stood for 410, 20 years. They're exiled again. But this one doesn't last 70 years. 100 years go by, 200 years go by, 300 years go by. The Talmud is being worked on, and then the Talmud is sealed. Okay, great. Maybe now, year 700, year 800, 900, 1,000. The Jews are now rooted in Ashkenaz. They're rooted in France and in Germany. The Crusades are happening in the last 10 years, which is a battle between the Muslims and the Christians over who owns Jerusalem and where are the Jews? Forgotten. Not part of the equation. The world is debating, not like today, where we're the center. The Jewish people are in the center of the debate of who owns Jerusalem. We're not players. Mired in an endless exile. We're 1,000 years after Rashi. But already then, how long? When is this going to end? There's nothing on the horizon telling anyone that we're almost there. Exile's almost over. And what's Rashi's opening comment as you start to learn Chumash, as the Muslims and the Christians are killing each other over who owns Jerusalem and slaughtering Jews along the way? Rashi's first comment is, Bereishit bara Elokim, God created this world. He gave the land to the people of Canaan when He wanted to, and when He desired, He took it from them, and He gave it to us. And then there was a point, no, He doesn't say it, when He took it from us, and He gave it back to them. And the message He's giving us as we begin learning Chumash, wherever in the world we are, but that land is ours. And we start with Bereishis, because you can't just start with a book of law. You have to know the background story. You have to know the story of creation. There'll be a time when He'll give it back to us. But right now, might not be ours, Rashi writes, in the year 1100. But that's the opening comment. God gave it to us when He saw fit. I want to take this theme. Let's learn through each one of His opening comments to the books. Number 2, His first comment to the book of Shmos, middle of page 3. Eilu Shmos b'nei Yisrael. How does the book of Shmos begin? These are the names of the children of Israel, children of Yaakov, and we list Reuven, Shimon, they have all the children. Rashi's bothered by a question. This is Rashi's first comment. We just counted them at the end of Bereishis. The Torah goes through. All the brothers had lived the end of their lives in Egypt and Mitzrayim after they were reunited with Yosef, and they had children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and then the book of Bereishis ends, and Shmos begins, and it begins with accounting and telling us again their names. We know their names. We read it the previous week in Shul. Rashi says, even though we counted them during their life, it again enumerates them, Lehodia Chibotam, to let it be known how beloved the children of Yaakov were to Hashem. What's the theme? What's the message right? It's answering a textual problem. Why are we counting them again? What's the textual, technical answer? Tell us Hashem loves them. And what's the message to us?
Hope.
And the literal word He uses, chiba, is love. Rashi opens Bereishis with, He created this world and He gave you that land when He wants. And he opens Shmot with, He loves you. That's why He counts you. He counted the 12 tribes during their life and He counts them again after they died. Let's go to Vayikra. First comment in Vayikra. Vayikra begins with the phrase, Vayikra el Moshe, Hashem called to Moshe. Rashi says, L'chol dibros u'l'chol amiros u'l'chol tzivuim kadma kriya. This idea of Vayikra, that Hashem called to Moshe, even though it's only listed here, but really every time that Hashem speaks to Moshe, He introduces it with Vayikra. He called out to Moshe. So don't think it's just this one time, Rashi says, that Hashem called out to Moshe. Hashem always called out to Moshe. Moshe! Moshe! Before He spoke to him every single time. Why? Says Rashi. Lashon Chiba. It's a language of
love.
Picking up on a theme just yet? First comment in Bereishit, Hashem chose you and He gave you the land. First comment in Shmot, He counts you and lists your names because it's a language of love. First comment in Vayikra, He called out to Moshe because it's a language of love. Guess what's coming up? Number 4, first comment in Bamidbar. I'm giving you a Dvar Torah for your Shabbos table. Every time we start a new book, you have you're ready to go. Torah begins Bamidbar with another count of the Jewish people. And Rashi's bothered by another count? How many times do we have to count the Jewish people? We just counted them. It's Rashi's first comment on Sefer Bamidbar, number 4, the bottom of page 3. Mitoch chibatan lefanav. Because they were so dear and beloved to him, he counts them. He counts them when we left Egypt, Rashi says. He counts them after we fell from the golden calf to see how many were left. And he counts them now as he's about to dwell a Shekhinah amongst them. He again wants to take a census. Why does he take a census? Because he loves us. Rashi's first comment. He loves us. And lastly, number 5, top on page 4. First comment in Devarim, which are the words of Moshe. Eila Devarim asher diber Moshe. These are the words that Moshe said. Says Rashi, lefi shein divrei teichachos. Since these are words of reproof and rebuke. Umana kan kol ha-makom ha-shehechiso. Moshe is going to go through all the problems that we had in the 40 years. Lefikach sasam es ha-devarim v'ezkirim v'remez. That's why they're all hinted at. Mipnei kvodon shel Yisrael. Out of the honor and out of the regard for the Jewish people, he didn't want to rebuke them openly. It's hinted at. And again, the idea that comes forth, the kavod, the honor, the relationship. And I think it's worth, as we begin studying, every opening comment Rashi has, he wants one message to come out. Hashem has a relationship with us. He chose us. He gave us our lands. He loves us. He counts us. Every calamity, when the Jewish people fell in the desert, counted them again. What do I have left? As we begin the journey into the day, count them again. He calls out to us, to Moshe, the language of chiba. The element of chiba or kavod or being chosen is part of every comment Rashi makes to begin a book of the Chumash. And that speaks volumes for the message that he wants to convey to us. Okay, good? Let's take an example. Let's learn Rashi together. A number of Rashis. We're going to learn a Pasuk, and we're going to go through it the way we need to go through to learn Rashi. I chose the first Pasuk in this week's Parsha. I could have chosen any Pasuk in the entire Chumash, but I figure this week's Parsha, you'll have a Dvar Torah for your Shabbos table. Number 6, ready? I'm going to read a Pasuk. It's a simple Pasuk. Before you look at all the Rashis, let's go through together 5 textual problems that we need to ask if we're a student of Chumash, and we read this pasuk, 5 questions. Here we go, here's the pasuk. Vayeiro elav Hashem ve'elonei Mamre. Hashem appeared to Avraham in Elonei Mamre, in the plains of Mamre. V'hu yoshev pesach ha'oel, he was sitting at the foot of the tent, at the entrance of the tent, kechom hayom, in the heat of the day. That's the opening pasuk in this week's parsha. The second pasuk is going to say, "Vayisa, you know, Vayar." Avram lifted up his eyes and he saw 3 people were coming towards him, and that's the famous story of the 3 angels who came to visit him. That's the next pasuk. 5 problems with this first opening verse. Go ahead, give me a hand. Oh, come on, all these people. Hashem appeared to him in the plains of Mamre, who Yoshev Pesach Ha'Oel. He was sitting at the entrance of the tent Kechol Mayom in the heat of the day. Okay, now I have some questions. What was that? Okay, why is it relevant that it was the heat of the day? So again, we're going to put ourselves in Rashi's shoes. Why is that relevant? Let's say the Torah would have left out that detail. Avram was sitting. It was sitting at the entrance of his tent, and it wasn't the heat of the day. Why is it relevant that it was the heat of the day? Good. Question number 1.
Why Hashem came to see him?
Excellent. Better than that. Meaning, taking that. The next pasuk says, as I mentioned, it's in the English. Avram lifted up his eyes, and he saw the 3 people coming forward. So, when Hashem appeared to him, what did Hashem say to him?
Nothing.
Nothing. We don't have anything. It's just the pasuk says Hashem appeared to Avram. And now, if I'm reading Chumash, the next pasuk should say, and what did he say to Avram when he appeared to him? What did the next pasuk say? Then Avram lifted up his eyes, and he saw 3 strangers, and he ran to greet them, and the whole story of the... So what did Hashem do? What did he say to him? Question number 2. Good. So we have 2. Yes, next.
Why does he sit in front of the
tent? Why is it relevant that he's in the front of the tent? Let's say he was in the back of the tent, or in the middle of the tent. If it's not relevant, then why do I need to know it? If it's relevant, why is it relevant? What's... So why is he in the front of the entrance of the tent? Why is it the heat of the day? What is Hashem doing when he appears to him? Yes? Yeah, what did he do when he appeared to him? Yeah, next.
What's important to remember?
Good, location. Where is he? He's in the plains of Mamre. Anybody know where that is?
No.
Does it matter where it is?
No.
So why are we told where it is? So Rashi's got all these problems. Simple pasuk opening. I mean, I know you know all these questions from every year when we read the Parashat Shavuot, you're in shul, and like all these questions flood your mind. But by the time you think of all these questions, the Baal Kor is already halfway through the Aliyah. So you can't stop and think about it. So we have so far, why does Hashem appear to him if he doesn't say anything to him? Who cares where he is in the plains of Mamre? Why is it relevant that he's sitting at the entrance of his tent? And who cares that it's the heat of the day? We need to answer all these questions. There's one more grammatical question. And Rashi does all these things all together. How do you spell the word Yoshev? Yud, Vav, Shin, Beth. Correct. That's how you spell Yoshev. How does the Torah spell it? It's missing a Vav.
Yashav.
Yashav, which is another one of the examples the Torah does not have punctuation, which means that it's pronounced by tradition Yoshev, but if you were just reading it, it would be read Yoshav. So it's pronounced presently sitting, but it's read as if he sat.
In the past.
Okay, so far so good. So now we're a bunch of Rashi scholars. Rashi's bothered by all five of these questions. What's the pshat? What is the Torah trying to tell us? No, we could just read it as a story that Hashem was sitting, Avram was sitting, and Hashem came to him, and let's move on. But if we want to be students of the text, what's the meaning of all these details? So, why don't we read some Rashi together? All right, let's do it. Even though you didn't answer, I assumed that the answer was yes. Okay, so on page 4, from there on out, you see there are 5 bolded comments. All of these are the comments of Rashi. He's going to address each one of these questions. Now, what I want to do is learn them and then also just comment together with you as to what are the messages, besides for just the textual problem, what is the message that Rashi is trying to convey to us through his comments? Again, this is just a random pasuk. It happens to be that this is this week's parsha. This is just an example of what Rashi does for us. So far, so good? And Hashem appeared to him. Says Rashi, Levaker es hachoyla, to visit the sick. Amar Rabbi Chama bar Chanina, Rashi quotes the Medrash, Yom Shlishi l'milosohay. This was the third day from his bris milah. The previous parsha ended last week with the commandment to give himself a bris milah. He was 86 years old. He was recovering on day 3. Hashem came to check on him. Where did the Medrash get this from? 99 when he has his son Yitzchak. He was 86 when Yishmael was born. He had a bris. Where did Medrash get this from? What's Rashi answering? How it connects, but more than that, what was one of the 5 questions we asked? Hashem came to him and didn't say anything to him. We have a different answer for that. Hashem came to him and didn't say anything. So if Hashem came and appeared to him, and then the text just goes on that Avram sees the 3 people coming and he runs and he gives them food. There's never any communication. So if Hashem never spoke to him, what's he doing there?
Comfort.
Brings Rashi from the Medrash, comfort. He came to visit the sick. Now, many students in school will right away say that Hashem came to visit. I'm sure that my kindergartner or first grader will come home with the Dvar Torah that Hashem came to visit the sick. Is that in the Chumash?
No.
Who made that so famous? That's Rashi's comment, who's bothered by the question, which he doesn't ask, by the way. One of the keys to learning Rashi is you always have to ask yourself, what's he answering? If we just read this Rashi again, what does Rashi simply say? Hashem appeared to visit the sick. He's answering a question that he didn't ask, which we already went through. What question did he not ask that he's answering? What did Hashem appear for if he didn't say anything? So when you see a comment from Rashi, the first thing you have to do is say, what's he answering? Oh, he came to visit the sick, because what else was he doing there? That's what Rashi's bothered by. Answers Rashi, bringing from the sages, Bikur Cholim. We learn here, so great is the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. Hashem himself comes to visit Avraham as he recovers from his bris milah. So that when the Rambam, Maimonides, who we'll study in a few weeks, writes that we have a mitzvah of v'halachta bidrachav, we have a mitzvah to walk in the way of God. And he brings a number of examples. And one of the examples that we have to emulate Hashem is Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick. Where in the Chumash do you see Hashem visited the sick? Right here. In the text or in Rashi? Rashi. When I just, parenthetically, I have a game, Pesach time, the Seder time is a great time for games to be able to play, to bring out the story. So I have a game that I play at my Seder table. We've done a number of years running, and it's called Text or Rashi, in which I give pieces of information of the Pesach story, and it's usually we do boys against girls in my family and our guests, and we take turns whether or not the piece of information that I share about Yetzias Mitzrayim is actually in the text, or it's a Rashi. And believe it or not, most of the times it's hard to discern because Rashi's comment has become so much part and parcel of the way we tell the story. It's a great game, and it also is a great way to bring out the story because you share a lot of information and it gets into a lot of... But it's... So here, Hashem comes to visit. The text says Hashem appeared to him. Rashi's comment, he came to visit. Let's go on. We got a lot to do. Be'lunei Mamre. In the plains of Mamre, we ask the question, who cares? Who cares where Avram's tent is pitched at that particular time? Says Rashi, Hu shenasam lo eitza al hamila. Mamre was one of Avram's colleagues. We read about this last week. And he gave Avram advice regarding the mitzvah of bris milah. This is the whole discussion. Why did Avram ask for advice? It's a separate shir. We're not going to get into that right now. Believe it for as they had a discussion. And Mamre advised Avram, Hashem told you to do it. Let's go ahead. It's going to be okay. Don't worry. Lefikach niglo lov bechalko. Therefore, Hashem appeared to Avraham in Mamre's piece of land as a reward for Mamre's role in the dialogue that they had regarding Bris Milah. Okay, two levels again. How has Rashi technically answered the question that he has? His question was again, who cares where he is? What's his answer? It's a reward for Mamre that since he gave, he positively responded to the mitzvah of Bris Milah. What's the message Rashi's giving us?
Someone who gives good advice deserves to be honored.
There's a response. Mamre did something positive, and there was a response. Correct. There was a response. There are, sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle, messages that when you just read, when you know Chumash and Rashi, there are messages that come through. Rashi says, Mamre did X, and there was a result. There was a response. That something began. And that is a fundamental tenet of everything that we believe. Our actions are not meaningless. Every choice we make, every word we say, every action that we do brings a response. We don't always see that. We don't always see it not only in our lifetime, but everything has a response. Why is the Torah telling us it's in the plains of Mamre? Because that's the reward. He did something and he got that in reward. Let's go weiter. Next. Yoshev. Now Yoshev was misspelled. It says that he was sitting, but it says it as if he was previously already or had sat down. Now this is very relevant to last week's discussion. Rashi says, Bikesh la'amod. Avram wanted to stand up. Why did he want to stand up, would you say? Hashem just appeared to him. The first thing you do is you stand up. So he wanted to stand up. And Hashem said to him, Shave. You sit. Why? I really should have done this Rashi last week, but I figured we'd cover it this week. Atosimon levanecha. You are going to be a sign for your children. Sha'asidani lehisyatzev ba'adas hadayanim. I, Hashem, will stand in the company of judges. Vehein yoshvin, and they will sit. Maral, one of the classic commentaries on Rashi, explains what Rashi means with this is what we discussed last week. When we want to know when it's going to be Rosh Hashanah, who determines when it's Rosh Hashanah? When we want to know whether or not a rule is mutter or asr, it's permitted or forbidden, who decides? Now Hashem can go either way with it. But who decides how we act in practice, we discussed last week? We do. So Hashem says to Avraham, at this moment of the Bris Milah, the covenant sealed between Hashem and the Jewish people, Hashem says, you sit, I stand. You know why? Because when they're going to be judges, they're going to sit in judgment, and I, God, King of Kings, Kaviyachol, will stand as if to await their decision. This goes back to what we spoke about last week, the power of the oral law, and the sages, the chachamim, and the partnership, And Hashem already puts that into place at the recovery of the covenant between Hashem and Avraham. You sit, as if he's been commanded to sit, because I'll stand and watch and wait, just like the judges will sit and I'll stand. We're going to mimic that right now at this moment. Very important Rashi that ties into that discussion. Pesach Ha'ol, he was at the entrance of the tent. Why is that relevant, we ask? Says Rashi, Lirosim yesh over v'shov v'yachnisam b'veis. So to see if anyone was passing by, that he could bring him into his house. What's the message Rashi's conveying? Again, there's a technical answer. He's got a problem. Why is he relevant? He's at the entrance of the tent. He gives us a technical answer. He wanted to see if anyone was passing by. And what is he conveying to us? You know how you do chesed? You don't wait for it to come to you? Correct. Now again, this piece of information, a kindergartner comes home that Avram was looking. Where does it come from? From the sweetness of Rashi, Avram recovering at the entrance of his tent. Now we would just read the pasuk, he's at the entrance of his tent. Says Rashi, no, don't just read past that. He's looking. He's looking. And last Rashi, kechom hayom, was in the heat of the day. And we asked, who cares that it's the heat of the day? Says Rashi, now he's quoting from the Medrash. Hotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu chama min artika. Hashem took out the sun, so to speak, from its sheath, making it extremely hot and uncomfortable. Why? So that Avram shouldn't be troubled by visitors. He's recovering from his bris mila. It's day 3. It's hard. Let him rest a little bit. And then Rashi says, in my mind, one of the most powerful, instructive phrases in the entire Chumash. And again, just by chance, it happened to be, it's the first pasuk in Vayera, which is what we're studying this week. Says Rashi, Ra'a, so I just want to read it inside, and I raw ulafishi ra'uhu mitzta'er. Hashem saw that Avraham was troubled. He was pained that he didn't have guests. That phrase, my friends, not only does Avraham, as Rashi brings out to us, did he sit at the entrance looking for chesed, what happened when there was no one? It's the most beautiful word, mitzta'er. You know, you ever have somebody, a friend who's making a simcha, and you call him up on a Tuesday before the wedding, and you or wedding or bar mitzvah, and you say, if you have any out of town guests and you need somebody to put up for Shabbos, I have a room available. And you like wait, and like Wednesday goes by, no call, and Thursday goes by, no call, and by Friday morning, like, yes. Avram is looking, and he sees there's no one. And he's mitzta'er. Bothers him. It's painful. So not only does Rashi bring out, again, we read a pasuk, right? Avram was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day, and we would have just gone on to the next pasuk. What does Rashi convey to us in this pasuk? Not only does he convey bikur cholim, the requirement to visit the sick, not only does he require that there's a concept called schar va'onesh, of reward and punishment, and everything that we do has a response, and therefore was in Mamre's portion of land. Not only does Rashi then convey to us this idea that Hashem is going to stand while Avraham sits to convey the significance of the sages, that they will make decisions, and Hashem himself will wait. He then conveys what it means to do kindness is to go out there and find it. And if you can't find it, that should tear you up inside. I'm stuck here by myself. I can't do kindness for anybody. All of that, my friends, in that Rashi, in that first pasuk, Vayera Elov Hashem Be'elonei Mamrei, Fu Yoshev Pesach Ha'oel Kechom Hayom. 10-11 words of the pasuk, and Rashi has conveyed all of that. That was a random pasuk. It just happened to be the first pasuk of this week's parsha. This is the beauty. Now again, what Rashi did, there are pages and pages of midrashim on these psukim, and Rashi gave us just what we need in the concise wording that we need that can be studied by a kindergartner who's going to come home with the Dvar Torah at the Shabbos table, and studied by the scholars. I mentioned the Maral works through why specifically at the time of the Bris Mila does Hashem stand, and why there's like so much to talk about. all in this one little piece. Okay, we have a lot more to do and not much time, so let's move on. I have to just quickly mention that Rashi also, I want to learn more Rashi's with you, but I just have to mention that he also wrote a tremendous commentary on the Talmud. This class would not be complete if we didn't mention his commentary on the Gemara. 2,711 pages of the Talmud. 30 out of the 39 tractates Rashi commented on. The way that he commented on the Gemara is different than what he did in Chumash. In Chumash, his goal was to cull from the Talmud, from the Medrash, and give us a concise reading that both explained the verse and gave us all that we need as Jews, all the messages that were necessary. And the Talmud, his goal was literally a running commentary, phrase by phrase. The Gemara also was without punctuation. Hard to know where a question ends and where a question begins. Was this phrase, is it supposed to be a question or a statement? Is it a proof? It's a closed book. Very, very difficult book to read. And Rashi, phrase by phrase, guides us, holds our hand along the line, along the way. It's called a kuntres. It was a notebook because when Rashi began, we didn't have Rashi. All you had was the actual text of the Talmud, and the students had notebooks of all the traditions passed on over the last 400 or 500 years since the Talmud had been sealed of commentaries. And Rashi gathered all the traditions, edited, organized, added his own, and left us with this legacy, this gift of his commentary to the Talmud. Again, there is no Gemara, none, that is printed without Rashi. You have to. You can't print a Gemara without Rashi. Yeah, I think I shouldn't say this so strongly. Maybe you can, but you have to have Rashi. I just don't know. Like, that's the starting point of every student is to learn Gemara with Rashi. I put in my notes here, like, the worst feeling as a yeshiva student is when you get stuck on a line. So the first thing you do is you're stuck on a line, you know how to read it. So what do? You say, all right, what does Rashi say? And then you look over to Rashi, and lo and behold, he doesn't say anything. That's the worst. You know why that's the worst? Not just because it means you're stuck, it means it's so simple that Rashi didn't even feel the need to comment. So at least when there's a Rashi, okay, I know, like, listen, Rashi felt this was a difficult line, and now he's going to hold my hand and take me through it. If he didn't say anything, then this is like child's play. Those are the worst feelings when you get stuck on a line without even Rashi to help you, because he's also insulting you by telling you, like, this you didn't know, like, I can't give you everything. But that the enormity of his commentary is such. Again, I want to learn more Rashi's with you, so I'm going to just mention that about the Gemara, and let's learn a little bit more. I want to share some other thoughts because of the significance. But as we finish up, number seven on the top of page 5. So I want to share with you a number of, again, classic Rashi's. We could have chosen 100, but I just have 3 or 4 that I want to learn together with you. Rashi is our Rebbe in humility, and he expresses this in a number of different ways. In a couple of weeks' time, at the end of, I think it's Parshas Toldos, the Torah describes, Vayishlach Yitzchak es Yaakov, Vayelech Paden Aram, after Yaakov steals the brachas from Esav. So Rivka, his mother, tells her husband Yitzchak, you know, we need to send Yaakov away, he needs to find a wife. And so Yitzchak sends Yaakov away to Lavan ben Besuel, Achi Rivka, to Rivka's brother, Eim Yaakov ve'Esav. And the Torah says that Rivka is the mother of Yaakov and Esav. Now, how long at this point? We've been discussing Yaakov and Esav and their mother Rivka for an entire parsha. Yaakov already stole the bracha. His mother Rivka is the one who gave him the cloth. We know that Rivka is Yaakov's mother and Esav's mother. And here at the very end of the story, when Yitzchak sends Yaakov away, and it says, and his mother was, his wife Rivka was the mother of Esav and Yaakov. So what's the question? Why are we being told that? Rashi gives such a beautiful answer. Rashi says, "Eini yodea ma milamdenu." I don't know what this is teaching us. Brilliance. It's brilliance in its honesty. There is a, now, if I were writing a commentary and I was as verbose as Rashi, I commented on as many things and had as many brilliant things to say, and then there was one thing that I didn't know, okay, I would just pass over that and nobody would know the difference. And Rashi says, in his intellectual honesty, this is a problem. I don't know the answer. This, Rashi, is what has given scholars for 1,000 years the permission with confidence to say, I don't know. I don't know. It's a great question. I believe there is an answer, because if God put it in His Torah, there is an answer. I don't know what it is. And then Rashi went, weiter, he went to the next pasuk. And he said the words, Eneni yodea ma milamdenu. I don't know what this teaches us. Which implies, there is something that this teaches us. I don't know what it is. Eneni yodea. It's an amazing thing. And again, I use this liberally, much more liberally. Rashi says this maybe two or three times in the entire Chumash. I say it every week. I don't know. I'll get back to you. I'll look it up. What gives me the right to say that? Oh, if Rashi can say that, I can say it too. Rashi is our Rebbe in humility. Example number two, number eight. Rashi's talking about the ephod. The ephod was one of the garments of the Kohen. Rashi says, Lo shamati velo matzati bebraisa perish tavnisa. I have heard no tradition, nor have I found in any statement from the sages any description of what the ephod looks like. I have no history. I have no tradition. I have no source. Velibi omerli. And he uses a beautiful phrase. But my heart tells me that it looks like this. And he goes through a description of something that he saw in the streets of Tois, of a woman who was wearing a certain garment, and he says, I think this is what it was. And how does he introduce that? Libi Omerli. I don't have a source. I'm not saying this because I know. And he introduces it with, this is what I think. This is what my heart tells me is the meaning or the appearance of what exactly this is. He makes that same comment later in the very same comment. Again, he says, Va'od Omer Li Libi, my heart says that it looks like this, and he brings a proof. Just a beautiful phrase. Last comment on humility, number 9, bottom of page 5. In the beginning of Sefer Vayikra, the Torah describes the various sacrifices, offerings, karbanos that are brought by an inadvertent sinner. If a person, a Jew, does something wrong inadvertently, and it's a specific type of category of sin, so he brings a karban, he brings an atonement offering. And there's the standard atonement offering, and then the Torah lists specific people. Im Kohen Gadol, if a high priest makes a mistake. Or if a king, the melech yechetov the king. And then we get to the prince, or actually the nasi, the leader. And here the Torah changes from the language of im, if he will sin. And the Torah says, asher nasi yechetov, the bottom of page 5 in the box. When a ruler sins, and he does one of the commandments that Hashem says, and he should not be done, and he does it, he becomes guilty. And Rashi is bothered by that first word, asher, which means when he sins, as opposed to if he sins. Now, if I'm a leader, if I'm the king, I would want the Torah to say, if I sin. But the Torah says, when you sin. Rashi comments, bottom of the page, Lashon Ashrei. It's a language not just of if, when, but happy or praiseworthy, says Rashi. Ashrei hador shehanasi shelo. Praiseworthy is a generation who has a leader who gives attention to bring an atonement sacrifice for an inadvertent sin. It's the message Rashi's conveying throughout, echoing throughout the generations. The Torah switched the word, and Rashi wants to highlight what a generation that has a leader who acknowledges their mistakes. Praiseworthy is such a generation. The Jewish people grow up for 1,000 years with Rashi, and what is the greatest trait of leadership? Not that you have a leader who never makes a mistake. Not that you have a leader who's perfect. Asher yachata. It's going to happen. And praiseworthy is a generation that has a leader who can admit it. What has this Rashi done for centuries of leaders, given them the opening to say, I made a mistake? And when they get up there in front of their congregations, in front of their schools, in front of their communities, and they say, I erred, what can they open their drasha with? The beautiful words of Rashi. Praiseworthy is a generation that has a leader that's not perfect. This one, if, but the leader, when it happens. But praiseworthy is he who's able to acknowledge it. Let's move on. I want to finish up. He's also our ethical guidepost for Jewish trauma at the end of Sefer Devarim. The Torah has a famous passage of remembering what Amalek did to us. And when the Torah introduces Zachore, Sasher, Asal, Lochal, Amalek, as we're familiar, remember what Amalek did. The previous verses, right before telling us about Amalek, tells us to have honest weights and measures. You may not have two stones, a correct stone and an incorrect stone, a good scale. You know how to do that. Every weight and measure has to be exact. And Rashi comments, why are these two verses juxtaposed, having honest weights and measures with Amalek? Says Rashi, because if you use false weights and measures, then be doeg, be afraid and apprehensive, mi gerue ha'oye, from the provocation of the enemy. That's why they're there. You don't want to know Amalek? You want to know what brings about Amalek? If you're not careful with your weights and measures, you're going to get Amalek. What's the message Rashi's giving us? Remember, we're living in Christian Europe, the beginning of the Crusades, 1,000 years into our exile. What is the easiest thing to blame for our problems? That's the truth. But what's the easiest thing to blame for our problems? Everybody around us. And it takes the form of the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the French Christians, the German Christians, the Palestinians, you name it. The easiest thing is to say, that's the problem. And just switch the name of the enemy. Switch whatever method they're using to harm us. Says Rashi, on the greatest enemy of the Jewish people, Amalek, Rashi comments, when you read that first verse, Zachor es asher asa lecha Amalek, when you remember what Amalek did, and what does Rashi tell us to remember? If you're not honest, that's when they come. So next time you have a problem, look in. Figure out what we're doing wrong. Because we're not in exile because of the Palestinians. Just in case you thought that's why we were still in exile. We're not. We're in exile because we haven't become the people worthy of being redeemed. And Rashi tells us on that pasuk, don't ever forget, it's your weights and measures that bring about the enemy. He's also our spiritual conscience. Rashi, on the pasuk of not to curse a blind person or a deaf person or place a stumbling block in front of the blind, Rashi says, the pasuk concludes, Ani Hashem, I am Hashem, your God. Rashi says, any case which a sin is not given to human beings to know whether or not the intention of the offender was for the advantage or disadvantage of the person whom he advised and gave bad advice to, meaning, some sins, if you look at, you see the person is doing a sin. He's eating non-kosher meat. That's obvious. But there are other things that nobody will know what you're doing. There's only one person who's going to know, one thing, one entity. Only God knows what you're doing. Rashi comments, every time, Rashi says, something is between you and Hashem, the pasuk adds the phrase at the end, Ani Hashem, I am God. No one's going to know what's going on. And so when you learn Chumash and Rashi, in the back of your mind, you always have that idea, Ani Hashem. No one else is going to know, but I will. And that becomes part of our consciousness. I will conclude our last Rashi with his confident in the compassionate redemption on the verse at the end of Devarim in Zos HaBrocha, that Hashem is like an eagle who rouses his nestling guide, gliding down to his young. Rashi says, Hashem guides us with mercy and pity like an eagle full of pity towards his young, and does not enter its nest suddenly. And an eagle, Rashi says, wants to arouse. He doesn't just appear. He hovers above, beating and flapping its wings to slowly let its young know mama's coming. And the young become accustomed, become aware, become awakened to the presence of the mother bird. And then she comes and places them on her back, not afraid of anything other than the hour from below. Hashem will protect us in the same way. And Rashi leaves us with the message, when Hashem will appear, he will not appear suddenly in a way that will startle his children, but will hover above, slowly awakening us, arousing us to his presence, when the redemption has come. The Rashi writes 1,000 years, but if I can go out on a limb and say what we're watching unfold is a slow step-by-step process in which it's not in the middle of the medieval Europe where all of a sudden the redemption suddenly comes and, well, what's this? A process of arousal, of awakening, of making us aware of what's going on. And Rashi leaves us with that message as we conclude part of what we were starting with. Let me just finish up very, very quickly. I know it's 9 o'clock and I want to finish. Rashi, we have, besides for his writing, we have a number of responses from him and poems and elegies that he wrote after the Crusades. He died in 1105 and was buried in Troyes. But the did I say that right? Did I get it?
Troyes.
Troyes. I know that's wrong. I can't do it. We actually lost the location of the cemetery in the centuries after the Jews left, after the Crusades and everything was in the centuries that followed. We lost where the cemetery was. The great Rashi, the tragic note of the end of this luminary, we don't know where his cemetery is. There was a scholar, non-Jewish scholar, university professor, who in one of his studies discovered a map of the, I don't say ancient city, it was 1,000 years prior, the city of Troyes. And he found where the Jewish cemetery was, and it's beneath an open square in the modern day city. So if you go there now, there's, you know, an open, like a market, there's an open square, and he figured out, based on the map, that under the square is the old Jewish cemetery. And there's now a monument that the Jews of France erected in that open square. It's a beautiful monument that says, you are standing on the Jewish cemetery of Troyes, and here is buried the great luminary of the Jewish people, Rashi, which is a really terrible tinge of sadness that the great luminary Rashi is underneath a public square trampled upon in the French city of Troyes. I'll say it wrong on purpose. But Rashi has left us a legacy like no other Jew since the closing of the Talmud. You cannot learn Chumash, you cannot learn Talmud without him. I hope I've given you a small flavor of some of his commentary of love, of hope, of optimism, of chosenness, of the idea that through this long exile, the Jew has hope. The Jew is the nation of Hashem. There'll be a time when the land which was given to us and then taken from us will be again given to us as God arouses us from our deep exile, induced slumber to bring us back home on the eagles, on the back of an eagle, to the time of redemption. And that is our story of Rashi. There will be a Mariv in the shul now. And next week is not yet sponsored. And next week, Ramban Nachmanides will be taught by Rabbi Reuven Pupko of Beth Israel, Beth Aaron. And just in case there's any lack of clarity, the class will be here. I've just invited Rabbi Pupko to come here to deliver the lecture. So I look forward to seeing everybody here next week. This will be posted online. We'll post the sheets as well, the source sheets. And thank you all for coming. And we'll see you next week.